The time is about 3 o'clock. You are tuned to KTOO News. Welcome to a Juno Afternoon for Tuesday, November 26th. My name is Martha Moore, your host for today. Coming up in the next hour, we'll find out about the Church of the Holy Trinity's annual Christmas Bazaar. Christy Chambord will be here with the K2 auction update. We'll talk with Ken Fix about this week's planetarium show, and we'll find out about the school district's AVID program at the elementary level. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. The forecast today is calling for dense fog advisory until 9 p.m. this evening. Mostly cloudy, chance of rain, highs around 39.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Sea Alaska Heritage Institute shares knowledge about the practice of shamanism and Tlingit people of Southeast Alaska. As KTOO's Casey Kelly reports, elements are used in Tlingit culture today.
Shamanism used to be a major component of Tlingit life. Anthropologist and Sea Alaska Heritage Institute President Rosita Worrell says a shaman's responsibilities included maintaining the well-being of the clan, assuring hunting and fishing success, predicting future events, and curing illnesses. Worrell says every clan had a shaman before Russian and American colonization largely forced the Tlingit people to abandon their traditional religion.
However, we find that there are underlying aspects of the shamanic complex that still persist.
Worrell says that's perhaps most evident today in the use of sacred objects and regalia in Tlingit ceremonies.
We continue to believe that the spirits reside in sacred objects and that spiritual and social relationships exist between the natural and supernatural worlds.
While she says it's unlikely traditional shamanism will ever be completely revitalized, some Tlingits are looking at ways to incorporate more of the old practices in modern ceremonies. Worrell spoke as part of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute's Native American History Month lecture series. For National Native News, I'm Casey Kelly in Juneau.
Thursday marks the 44th annual Day of Mourning by a group of Indigenous people and their supporters held at Plymouth Rock on the coast of Massachusetts, the site of the Pilgrim's Landing in the 1600s. As Melinda Tuhus reports, the group says they use the day to dispel myths about the Thanksgiving holiday and discuss ongoing struggles of Native people.
Muanam James is co-chair of United American Indians of New England, which sponsors the event every year. It begins with a speak-out by Native people, then a march to commemorate the killing of the Indian leader Metacom by English settlers. James says since 1977, one of their demands has been to free Native activist Leonard Peltier, who was convicted of killing two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation. James believes Peltier has been unjustly imprisoned.
And every year he sends a statement to us, and we do demand freedom for him. Another one of our demands is that the Bureau of Indian Affairs pay up. They owe billions of dollars in royalties for oil drilling leases, land use leases all over the country. We also demand that the sports teams stop using racist logos.
James says his organization also raises money for Native people on reservations around the country who need assistance. The day ends with a meal served to hundreds of people in two Plymouth churches. I'm Melinda Tuhus for National Native News.
An Oklahoma tribe that was part of a legal battle to keep a little girl with her father is now fighting over tribal sovereignty in the case. KGOU's Kurt Gortney reports.
The Cherokee Nation has filed legal documents claiming it would be inappropriate, unreasonable, and unconscionable for baby Veronica's adopted parents to seek more than $1 million in legal fees. The tribe's legal argument is that federal and state law gives the Cherokee Nation sovereign immunity, but that protection would not apply to Dustin Brown. That's Veronica's biological father, who had custody of her for 2 years and fought a legal battle with the help of his tribe to keep her in Oklahoma. Matt and Melanie Capobianco of South Carolina filed a motion to collect those legal fees from Brown and the Cherokee Nation after they won custody of Veronica. A judge in Nowata County, Oklahoma, where Brown lives, will likely have a hearing on the issue, but no date's been set. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney.
In November 2011, Kansas Governor Sam Brownback issued a proclamation apologizing to tribes in the state for past mistreatments, including forced relocation. It was part of events to mark 150 years of statehood. This month, Brownback publicly apologized for Indian boarding schools at Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And you're tuned to KTOO News, and I have in the studio with me Pam Finley from the Church of the Holy Trinity. Welcome, Pam.
Well, thank you.
Great to have you here. And just 1 week ago, we were talking about pies, and how did that go?
It was fun, actually, believe it or not. And although I've made pies and rolled crusts for decades, I actually learned how to do it better. We made 144 pies.
Wow.
In less than 5 hours, we had about 15 people coring, slicing, peeling, mixing dough, rolling, putting on top.
Must have been very well organized.
It was very well organized. Jan McFeeters and Steve were the organizers. And yes, it was very well organized. Otherwise, I don't think we would have been able to do it. And 30 of the pies went to the glory hole.
Oh,
which
excellent.
Was nice. Yeah, yeah.
And do you have any left?
Well, I saved out 5 to bake on the morning of the bazaar so people can have, we'll be serving soup and bread from 11 to 2, and we'll also be serving pie by the slice. So people have a nice, warm, homemade, fresh apple pie.
So this week we're talking about the bazaar, and it is, I understand, on Sunday, December 8th.
No.
Oh,
wrong bazaar. Oops. I think that was Northern Lights Bazaar, or maybe, I'm not sure.
I thought Sunday sounded like an odd day for a church.
But this one is this coming Saturday, November 30th. It's the Saturday after Thanksgiving. It's from 9 to 3 with soup and bread from 11 to 2. I think it's the same weekend as the public market. And in the past, lots of times people have come. Well, we open at 9, and the public market used to open at 10. So unless they've changed their hours, people would come to see us for a little while and then head down to the public market, or they would go to the public market and then come up and have lunch and sort of shop where we were.
What's included in this year's bazaar?
Oh, many things. First, we have fresh evergreen wreaths. We buy them from Miss Scarlett's, and Snow decorates them. They're quite lovely, and they smell wonderful. We'll have the standard jams, jellies. We're going to have some lemon curd this year, I think. I have a list here. We'll have gift packages, window stars. Sarah Isto makes them, and they're quite lovely. You put them up on the window, and the light shines through them. They always sell out, so come early if you want those. We'll have friendship bracelets and the true Alaskan gift, duct tape wallets. I mean, you can't get much more Alaskan than that. And some denim coasters. We'll have treasures from the mustard seed, the little resale shop there that has some very lovely things. Plus some probably trinkets, ornaments, Christmas tchotchkes, that kind of thing. And then, as I said, from 11 to 2, we'll have soup, bread, and apple pie by the slice.
So the wallets, these are made completely out of duct tape?
I have not seen them yet. That was just listed on I asked people to put up, to write down what they'd be bringing, and that was on there. So people will have to see. I'll have to see what a duct tape wallet looks like. I'm intrigued.
The lunch, does that cost money?
Yes. It's it'll be $5 for the soup and bread. The soup's homemade. I think there's going to be a choice of salmon chowder, chili. There's another one. Oh, split pea. That'll be a vegetarian. And then a minestrone. That will also be vegetarian.
Sounds really yummy.
Yeah. It'll probably be a coolish day, so it'll be nice. People can come and eat and chat and shop.
And how many people do you usually get at this?
No, I'm not really sure. I would guess it probably depends. If the weather's really awful, probably more like 100. If it's better, I'd say a couple hundred, 250, People come through. Some people come through and they don't, you know, they just chop and leave. And other people come and they sit and at the table. We always put up tables and chairs and have coffee, and people can sit and chat with each other and chop and chat and chop and chat.
What's the location of this?
It's at McFeeters Hall, which is kind of on the down slope from the church. The entrance is on Gold Street between 4th and 3rd, and there's a little parking lot that's kind of on the 3rd Street end of things. Though there's also on the weekends, parts on-street parking is a lot easier to find downtown.
Is this a fundraiser for the church?
Yes, it's a fundraiser. We just sort of do fundraisers. When we rebuilt McFeeters and the community spaces on the downslope side, we had to take on debt. And while the congregation pays for the vast majority of that, obviously, as part of the regular budget, we try to supplement the budget with fundraisers. In a way, I'm glad that we do, because they're community builders. They're community builders within the church and between the church and the community, and even just sort of between members of the community. So it's they're kind of nice. They're fun things to have. I think most churches or lots of organizations have fundraisers, and you do it to kind of raise the money, but there's a lot of side benefits too.
And the congregation all pitches in, making these crafts.
Yes, making the crafts. And the patisserie is the one of the highlights of this. It's like a little French bakery. They even have the little hats, the French hats, and it's very nicely set up. And you get a Christmas tin, and then you get to choose your cookies. And they're all homemade cookies, everybody's best, and you can choose whatever assortment you want. I'll be making some that are gluten-free, too. We always try to have some gluten-free things for people.
That's a really great idea. So, again, that this is Saturday, November 30th.
Yes.
And it runs from 9 to 3. At McFeeters Hall. And if somebody wants to get some more information about this,
you can call the church office. They're open on the afternoons from 1 to 5. Allison will be there, and her number is 586-3532. Also, we have a website, which is trinityjuno.org, and that will have the phone number on it, too.
All right, great. Well, thanks so much for coming in, Pam.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, have fun at the bazaar.
Yes, I'm sure I will.
Okay.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Thank you.
And that was Amazing Grace by Branford Marsalis. You are tuned to a Juno Afternoon on KTOO News. And Christy Chambord is here to give us an update on the K2 auction. Hi, Christy.
How are you?
Good. Good to have you. And I heard you on Juno Afternoon yesterday, so I've kind of got an idea of what's going on here. But for those who missed it, could you just go over how this works this year?
Sure. So typically, K2 would be on the air all day on a Saturday, auctioning off all these great items. But this year we decided to offer bidding online so that people can kind of do it from the comforts of their home, from their smartphone, basically bid when it's most convenient for them.
That's a great idea. And I know that it's on the KTOO.org website.
Yes. There's two banners. There's one at the top corner and then one on the side. Can't miss it. And then once you click there, you'll be directed right to the auction page, and you just basically sign in, put in the information when you typically would have given a phone operator if we were having the real auction, and then you can start bidding.
And there's a wonderful array of bid items. I looked online, pictures, and, yeah, just a really great selection.
Yeah, we're really lucky this year. Our community, as always, is very generous to us, and we actually got some interest from some other companies this year as well, which was awesome. So we were able to put out a really well-rounded auction, I thought.
Mm-hmm. The deadline for bidding is when?
Is noon on December 5th. That is the last day you can make your bids. And you can start bidding as early as today, right now, if you want it.
And then what happens at noon on the 5th?
On the 5th, the auction will close, and then we'll process all of the winning bidders. Will immediately receive an email alerting them that they have won their auction items, and then we'll begin the process of going through the items, getting everything up to speed, and then for people who won physical items, you can start coming to the studio on December 6th, 10 a.m., and pick up your goodies. And for gift certificates, same thing, or you can opt to have it, we can mail it to you, whatever's easiest.
Explain the item of the day.
So the item of the day is an item that we'll offer just for the day. So today it is once again a hot out of the oven rhubarb pie. The bid is up to $45, and you only have till 4 o'clock today to bid on it, and then we close it, and the winner is the winner will be notified at 4, and they can come pick it up today.
By the end of this show.
Yes, exactly.
And as time goes on, more and more bids come in. There's a little bit of a bidding war going on.
There is. Think of it's very similar to an eBay setup. So if you can kind of alert yourself, you can set up to alert yourself when you've been outbid to jump back on and bid higher if you want. So yeah, there's bidding war going on for quite a few items actually. The Christmas tree is a hot item right now. We also have Nagoonberry liqueur. It is the last bottle from the season, so there won't be another one until next year. So that there's a little war going on with that, and still. For the bench, Colin Dukes donated an absolutely beautiful handcrafted bench, and it's neck and neck on that right now. So we're just waiting to see what happens.
There's a picture of that online.
Yes, there's pictures of everything online.
Many of these gift certificates are from businesses where people will spend money anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
like
there's
Nugget Outfitter.
Yep.
And, Bullwinkle's, McDonald's, Eagle Crest.
Exactly. We have lots of great things from Eagle Crest, so if you haven't gotten your pass yet, there's still time, and you might get a sweet deal on it through the auction, so definitely check it out.
And there are tickets to events?
We do. We have symphony tickets on there. We also have tickets for the spring show for the Juno Lyric Opera. That's on there as well. And for those who travel back and forth to Anchorage, we actually got a great donation from both Orso and Glacier Brewhouse. So if you travel back and forth, have a nice dinner, or if you have friends or family up there, it would make a great Christmas present.
Both excellent restaurants. I've been to both.
Excellent, yes.
And holiday gift certificates, I know, like manicures, pedicures.
Yeah, skin massages. Inspirations. There's one for, I think, a manicure and one for a pedicure on there. There's quite a few. There's great ones from Martha's Flowers. Just thinking ahead, flowers are always a wonderful gift, but we do have Valentine's Day coming up in February. You might want to think ahead. There's some great certificates for roses on there. And then also if you have a graduate in your life, she did offer a gift certificate for a graduation package, which is pretty cool.
I'm really intrigued by the exotic vacations that are listed, like to Panama. Well, actually, it's just a stay.
It is a stay.
But Panama, Antigua, and Barbados.
Yes, Elite Island Resorts manages some really awesome properties in the Caribbean. I know for people here, typically they think Hawaii, but maybe you want to start thinking outside the box a little bit. And the great thing about these, there are restrictions. I encourage everybody to please read the fine print. So you're bidding on a hotel stay for two at a three or four star resort, depending on where you're going. And the only thing that they mandate is that you pay for the meal plan. There is a meal plan at each of these resorts that is mandatory. So that's clearly written on there. But if you do the math and figure it out, it could be a really screaming deal for a really lovely vacation. So,
yeah, a lot of these items are a really good deal right now.
Yeah.
A real bargain.
Absolutely. So take a look at the auction. And if you have any questions, you can always call me here at the station, 463-6426, or send me an email. I'm directly linked to the auction. So,
where did you get the idea to do the auction this way?
Well, we were thinking about it last year after the spring auction. It's always so tense, and people are always like, oh, you had these great airline tickets, but it's really hard to decide something like that in just a few minutes. And so we were like, if we had the ability to bid online, it would give people a little bit of time to kind of marinate on some of the bigger items that they might want to take advantage of, but in the moment get a little nervous about. So we stretched it out and figure, with holiday shopping and all that good stuff happening around this time of year, we thought it'd be a good time to offer bidding online.
I think it's a great idea.
Thank you.
So check it out. You have 10 days until the bidding is over.
December 5th, yep.
Yeah, so that's about 10 days from now. And check it out on the KTOO.org website and all the great bargains that are still up there.
Great. Thank you so much,
thanks,
Martha.
Thanks for coming in, Christy.
Bye.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 26th of November, 2013. It's the birthday of the Theater of the Absurd playwright Eugene Ionesco, born in Slatina, Romania, 1909, but raised in Paris. And then at the age of 13, the family returned to Bucharest. He hated Bucharest. He felt confused there. Nazism was on the rise all around him. Once he was watching a German military parade. He watched a lieutenant rush up to a peasant who was standing nearby and slapped him and shouted at him for not removing his hat when he saw the Nazi flag. Ionesco said, "My thoughts were not yet organized or coherent at that age, but I had feelings, a certain humanism, and I found these things inadmissible. The worst thing of all was to be different from everyone else. Could I be right and the whole country wrong?" And that feeling led to Ionesco's lifelong struggle against authority. He turned to playwriting because, he said, it more easily allowed him to contradict himself. His first play was a one-act, an anti-play. He called it The Bald Soprano, an absurdist farce, no plot, the characters spoke in random non sequiturs, making fun of everything. It debuted in 1950, 2 years before Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. Eugene Ionesco was happily married for 58 years, lived in a Paris apartment, had many friends and colleagues, Hemingway, Picasso, Jean-Paul Sartre, Henry Miller, Juan Miró, and Max Ernst. Ionesco said, "My work has been essentially a dialogue with death, asking him why. Why?" It's the birthday of the writer Marilyn Robinson, born in Sandpoint, Idaho, 1943, author of many highly acclaimed novels, Housekeeping, Gilead, and Home. Marilyn Robinson, who said, "I grew up with the confidence that the greatest privilege was to be alone and have all the time you wanted. That was the cream of existence. I owe everything that I have done to the fact that I am very much at ease being alone. It's a good predisposition in a writer, and books are good company. Nothing is more human than a book. And it's the birthday of the science writer Jonathan Weiner, born New York City, 1953. His first book, Planet Earth, a companion volume to the Emmy-winning PBS television series. His latest book, Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality. Here's a poem for today by Katrina Vandenberg, First Snowfall in St. Paul. This morning, in the untouched lots of Target, St. Agnes, and Lake Phelan, girls all over the city, in the first snowfall of their 16th year, are being asked by brothers, fathers, my cousin Warren, to drive too fast, then lock their brakes to teach them how to right themselves, the whine of the wheels, the jerk when they catch, from Sears to Como Park to Harding High, the smoke that bellows from their lungs, the silver sets of jagged keys, the spray of snow, the driver's seat, the encouraging go. Katrina Vandenberg's poem, First Snowfall in St. Paul, from her collection Atlas, published by Milkweed Editions and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily online workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and are dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, with assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And the time is 3:29, and thanks for joining us here on a Juno afternoon. Ken Fix, my favorite astronomy geek, is here to talk about tonight's planetarium show.
Hi, Martha.
Hi, Ken. What's the topic of tonight's show?
Well, tonight is another one of the continuing episodes of the Mythology and the Planet series. Tonight I'm doing Zeus and Jupiter.
Why those two together?
Well, in ancient times, Zeus and Jupiter were identified as the king of the gods. In Greek mythology, it was Zeus. In Roman mythology, it was Jupiter. And, of course, they believed that that largest planet that was out there that you could see in the night sky, big and bright, was probably representative of the king of the gods. So they transferred that name of Jupiter to the planet, and that's what we've been calling it ever since.
Did they know it was a planet back then?
They thought that all of those things that they saw in the night sky were representations of legends and myths that they knew, and that the ones that were the swiftest moving were messengers of the gods or the gods themselves. So that's how they identified those faster moving wanderers became, you know, the planets, and they identified themselves with the Greek gods.
So I thought I saw Jupiter the other night, the night it was clear, maybe about, I don't know, 4 or 5 days ago. Is it possible I saw Jupiter out on the northeast?
Yes, very likely that was Jupiter, it might have been Venus. It's hard to say which direction exactly you were looking at, but it was more or less probably Jupiter or Venus.
It was very bright. And how many moons does Jupiter have?
Last count was 67. Of course, some of them are large. One of them, Ganymede, is larger than the planet Mercury. So that's the largest moon in the entire solar system. But there's ones that are, you know, like 30 miles across maybe, and I think that's more or less rubble. That's not really a moon, but, you know, we take space probes out there, and originally there was like 13 moons, then there became more, and then as soon as we send something else out there to you know, visually identify these really small objects that are in orbit around Jupiter, suddenly they're moons. So 67 at last count.
What else is interesting about Jupiter? I know it has that big red spot
Yes. They believe that that is an internal storm that is constantly there, and the coloring is actually because of the sulfur and sodium that comes off of the inner moon Io. So Io is inside the magnetic torus of Jupiter, and it constantly is blowing off volcanic activity. I mean, we were surprised we sent space probes by it, and there are volcanoes going off routinely because Io is so close in with Jupiter's gravity, it gets squeezed like a tennis ball, and its surface rises and falls like 330 feet during the course of a day. So it's because of that internal heating that it keeps that, you know, interior as molten, and, you know, volcanoes blow off, and this material is constantly flying into the orbit that Io takes around Jupiter, and when that material lands on the surface of Jupiter in the outer atmosphere, it colors it. So, you know, you got sulfur is kind of predominantly a yellowish color. Well, that's mixing in with a few other things in the atmosphere, and it's generating the color of the spot.
How many planets can we see with a naked eye here in Juno at any time?
I'll go out on a limb and say four. And the ones that you would be able to see is basically, if you can get them all in one time, it would be Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Mercury is too close to the sun to see. Most of the time, you'd only see it in the morning or late at night. And at those times, we have mountains blocking our view, so we hardly ever at all see Mercury.
The planetarium show that you're going to have tonight, is that the sky that we would see now if we could see the sky?
Yeah, and we sure can't see the sky here. You can't even see the tramway from here. It's crazy. We've got fog that's going to persist through the night anyways. But, yes, what happens is the stars do come out in Juno on the planetarium. I use the 1968 Spitz analog projector, which is like a giant arc lamp in the middle of a ball, and it has holes that are punched in it that make the actual constellations appear on the dome. So it's like a big projector, and, you know, we'll be able to create the night sky exactly as you would see it in Juno tonight, rain or shine.
You create the sky. You don't send a wafer like a Juno sky or...
No, we set the latitude and longitude into the planetarium, and that generates the night sky that you would see here. We can actually show the night sky any place in the world at any time. We just set it for the month, day, year, and the latitude and longitude, and I could set it up for Australia next week or 4 months from now if I wanted to.
Is that a computer program?
No, it's all old analog dials and knobs and stuff like that that you turn. We'd love to get a digital projector, and that's kind of one of the goals of the planetarium, is to raise enough money to get that. Unfortunately, it's about $100,000, and we're like not even a tenth of the way there yet. But eventually, hopefully with grants and whatnot, we'll be able to raise that kind of money and replace the Starball with a digital projection system.
So I kind of picture you like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain, and you're doing all this stuff.
I have no curtain there, but it's a big console that's up there in the front and everything. But I usually have one or two other volunteers that come in with me, and somebody will run the Starball. If nobody's there, though, I can run the entire thing and do the PowerPoint for the Mythology and the Planets show tonight.
Give us the time and the place of the show. I know it's tonight, but
sure. It's the Marie Drake Planetarium, and if you're coming from the valley, you take Egan until you see where the breakwater is, just as you're getting close to downtown. Make the left turn at the breakwater. Make the first right, which is Glacier Avenue. You'll go past the fences. As soon as the fences stop for the athletic fields, there's a sidewalk that goes into the Marie Drake Middle School building. And there's a funny-looking structure on the top of the building, which is the planetarium dome, the top of it, from the outside. And if you went past the Blockbuster video, you definitely went too far. So it's 6:30 tonight to 7:30 tonight. The stars tonight will also be shown on the Spitz projector. And then I'll do the mythology of Zeus as a Greek god. And then I'll do the planetary science of Jupiter.
It's okay to park out front of... Marie Drake there by that field? Is that where it is?
There are some parking along the street available, and there's also a faculty parking lot, and most of the faculty is gone by the time the show starts. So by 6:30, most of that activity is gone, and there should be some parking available. It's just beyond where the sidewalk is. The very next turn that you could make to the right would be the faculty parking.
Do you serve snacks or sell snacks?
No, not at these. In the summertime when we run the movies, then I, you know, we usually pop popcorn and we have that available for sale. But in the wintertime when we do our science-oriented programming, no, we don't.
Too much levity.
Well, it's a little much to have to do the show plus play concessionaire and stuff.
Yeah.
It's a little bit involved to do that.
You need a helper. Okay, well, thanks so much for telling us about that, Ken. So it's tonight at 6:30 at the Marie Drake Planetarium. It lasts about an hour, and thank you so much.
Thanks for having me again, Martha.
Support comes from the Copper Whale Inn, located in downtown Anchorage, near business and arts, activities, and events, with breakfast served daily, the Copper Whale Inn. Reservations online at copperwhale.com.
This is Bird Note. Massive volcanic eruptions brought forth the Hawaiian Islands from deep beneath the sea. How did these remote islands of lava rock grow lushly green with plant life? Birds played a vital role. Birds like the Pacific golden plover we're hearing now. Three-quarters of Hawaii's native flowering plants probably came from seeds that hitched rides with birds. Plant seeds travel with birds in several ways. Sticky or barbed seeds adhere to the feathers, much like the seeds stuck in your socks after a walk in a weedy field. Other seeds travel in mud caked on a bird's feet, and still others cross the ocean in the stomachs of birds. The bird-borne seeds that sprouted in Hawaii evolved into more than 1,000 new species. The most likely seed carriers were strong flyers like plovers or tropic birds, which travel thousands of miles across the Pacific. Or perhaps the seeds hitched a ride on the ancestors of this Akeapola owl we're hearing, caught in a storm and blown to the Hawaiian Islands. Today, both the flora and fauna of Hawaii compete for survival with invasive plants, such as the sandbur, and non-native birds like the Japanese white-eye. Given a chance and a boost from American Bird Conservancy and others, native species can rebound. Learn more at birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Spirit of Youth celebrates teenage Alaskans who are making our communities better places to live. They give their time, their hearts and minds, their passion, their creativity. Now, hear their stories.
That's 19-year-old Nelson Kinnick. He was the 2013 Youth Keynote Speaker at the annual Elders and Youth Conference hosted by First Alaskans Institute. The conference was held in Fairbanks this year, in the days before the AFN convention. Nelson was invited to speak about his involvement as a plaintiff in a legal case against the state's Department of Natural Resources. He and five other Alaska youth argue that the atmosphere is a collective resource and that it should be better protected against climate change. They lost the case in the lower court, but the Alaska Supreme Court recently heard it on appeal. Nelson says speaking to the crowd at Elders and Youth was pretty nerve-wracking.
Once I got into knowing what I to speak from inside, I kind of just went off. And after that, I didn't even see, you know, the nervousness that I had. It just went away after I got into tune with, you know, what I knew what I was going to share.
Nelson has also been part of video screenings for a short film called Trust Alaska. The video features him and his family at home in Kipnuk as they go about living a traditional life off the land. He says he wants to show others how some Alaskans see things and why those views matter.
What inspires me to work on this issue is to know that I'll still be able to have a community to go home to. and to share what I grew up with my kids and my grandchildren and other younger generations that would come.
Nelson is a freshman at UAF this year. I'm Shanna Sheehy.
Give a young person you know a boost by recognizing the good things they're doing. Nominate at spiritofyouth.org.
Provided by the Alaska State Division of Behavioral Health.
You're tuned to KTOO Juno, and my last guest is Pam Garcia. And she's here to talk about AVID at the elementary level. And a week ago, we had some high school kids and teacher Annie Janes to talk about AVID in high school. Pam is going to tell us about AVID at the elementary school level. Hi, Pam, and welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Tell us what AVID stands for.
Well, AVID is an acronym for Advancement Via Individual Determination.
And how does it work at the elementary level?
Well, at the elementary level, it's similar to at the secondary level, if you were listening last week, in that the whole mission is to close the achievement gap so that all students are prepared for college or careers, you know, later on. The way it is different is that at the elementary level, it's designed to be embedded into the daily instruction. Versus at the secondary level, it's an elective. So students choose to take AVID as an elective, and it's their strategies are taught within one elective course. Versus at the elementary level, it's embedded throughout the day.
Is this a philosophy of learning, or is it a series of skills that you teach the students?
It's kind of both. The philosophy would be that you really believe that each and every student can succeed for college if they want to go to college, or if not, just be successful in the global society. It's about preparing students to be successful in their future. And so that's the philosophy, that all students are capable of that. And it is a set of strategies, in that there are specific strategies that students are taught, some of them being organizational skills. So students at elementary level are taught how to use a binder, how to use folders to organize their homework or other content, you know, assignments from other content areas. They're specifically taught how to take notes, two-column notes, three-column notes, even the younger students, they can learn to, they have this thing called star notes, where S stands for setting up notes. The T stands for take notes. The A is adding information to your notes, and the R is to review their notes. So there's posters in the classroom to help students remember their skills when they're implementing their note-taking strategies. They're also taught how to be successful students. So what does a successful student look like? One thing that they're taught is called SLANT. And that's basically, the S stands for sitting up, proper posture. The L stands for leaning forward. The A stands for asking questions. N stands for nodding yes or no. So, you know, when the teacher's looking at you or asking questions, you're showing that you're paying attention. And the T is for talking with the teacher. So it's really teaching kids how to basically be accountable, be a good student. This is what it looks like to be a good student. So those are some of the strategies that students are taught. Organization's a big one. So the students at the fourth and fifth grade levels at Riverbend are keeping an agenda planner in their binder. So every day they write down what they learned that day, what their homework assignments are, and so they're taking responsibility for their learning, keeping track of what they need to be doing. The teachers do binder checks, so just making sure that things are intact, it's not going to fall apart with papers falling all over the place. So they're really teaching kids how to be organized. And they're also learning how to, like I said, take notes. And yeah, so those are some of the basic skills that kids are learning.
Is it used with every subject?
It's the intention is that it does, some form of it is used throughout every subject. So the classrooms that I'm an instructional coach, so I get to observe in all the classrooms and work with all the teachers K through 5. Specifically, Avid at Riverbend this year is being implemented in 4th and 5th grade, but you see these strategies being used all throughout the other grades as well, because the teachers share about Avid at staff meetings. We have family workshop, and kids are just learning what these strategies are beyond just the 4th and 5th grade. And now I forget what you asked me.
I was wondering if it impacted every subject.
Oh, well, yes. The students are, like the teacher will say, get your binders out or your homework folder out. Look at your agenda planner. And so, yes, in every subject they're having to be organized. In every subject they're having to show slant, to be paying attention. And some subjects they are taking notes, not in all subjects. And there's this also other strategy called wicker, and that the idea of wicker is that teachers intentionally think about wickerizing their lessons. That's another acronym. Avid has lots of acronyms. So the W stands for writing. The I stands for inquiry. The C stands for collaboration. The O stands for organization. And the R stands for reading. So when you think about any content area, well, how can we wickerize it? How would we embed writing into it? What kind of questions would we be asking students, or having them ask questions? And how are we going to have them collaborate? Will they work in partners? Will they work in teams? What kind of organizational skills do we expect them to be using during this content area? And what kind of reading will they be doing? Because even in math, the kids are having to read questions and write their answers. And in some cases, they're using two-column notes because they write perhaps a vocabulary word on one side of the notes, and then on the other side, on the other column, they would write the definition or draw a picture of the vocabulary word. So,
you mentioned Riverbend 4th and 5th. Now, is it being used in other grades or other schools?
Yes, yeah, specifically at Riverbend, we're in our second year of implementation, so the 4th and 5th grade teachers, myself, and the principal are a team, and we've all been trained in Avid, and the principal and I support the teacher. The superintendent, Glenn Gelbrick, and Patty Newman, the director of teaching and learning, are also part of our team. So we meet monthly to just stay with. We have made goals for ourselves, and so we just meet monthly to make sure that we are, you know, staying with working towards our goals. And so it is used in the 2 4th grade classrooms and the 2 5th grade classrooms. But like I said before, there are some of these other Avid strategies that all grades are using. Even in kindergarten, you'll see the teacher ask the kids to show me slant. It means like paying attention. Show me what it looks like to pay attention. And second and third grades, the kids are using binders and folders and learning how to be organized. And
is the goal to have this fully implemented in all grades, all schools?
The goal is to establish a culture of college readiness and being a successful student. So no matter what grade you're in or who you are, the goal is that all students are capable of being successful students. So, yes, the goal is that we have a culture in our school where everybody has this expectation that all kids will be ready for college or career.
It sounds as though the success of the program really depends a lot on the proficiency of the teacher to be able to implement this. Your job is, what is your job?
I'm an instructional coach, so I support teachers. I do a lot of professional development. I'll work with them in classrooms. I can work with students, look at student data. Sometimes we co-plan lessons together. Sometimes I observe and give teachers feedback. Sometimes they come in and ask me questions about something to get my feedback, or I'll provide them with resources. So any kind of support that I can give to teachers to help them implement this to their best ability.
And then beyond that, have they had special training?
Mm-hmm. Last summer, we went to a national AVID training in San Antonio, Texas, and it was very, very motivating. There was teachers from all over, and the big at the end was there were high school students who spoke to perhaps, I know there were at least hundreds of us, maybe there was more than hundreds, it could have been thousands. It was a big conference, but there were some high school students that came and spoke to how AVID really turned them around, that they hadn't had the skills. They didn't know how to be organized. They didn't know how to take notes. They didn't know how to study and be successful in school. And by learning these strategies with the AVID program, they really became successful in school and were able to make better choices and just do well. And some of the students, they brought tears to my eyes, their stories. I mean, they really had changed their lives around because their teachers, like what you said, the success is a big part of it is the teacher and just believing in their students, believing that all students can achieve, not just some, but each and every one.
Is this a pretty new initiative, and is it being done around the country?
Yes, it's being done nationally, and it's been around, I believe, for 30 years or so.
30 years?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically just really organizing how we develop the attitude that we can be successful and what does success look like, and let's just teach these kids and model it and take the time to do it without assuming that they'll just pick it up somewhere. And in the conference, we did this activity, and it was like, how many of you guys ever specifically learned how to take notes? You know, we're all teachers, we're college educated, many of us have master's degrees, and we were all thinking back at our elementary school education or middle school or high school, and it was like, did anyone ever really teach us how to take good notes? And it was like, no. You know, did anyone ever teach us how to, like, stay organized? And it was like, wow, the majority of us had never been explicitly taught how to those study skills that make it so students can be successful. And so that was just really eye-opening. So we take it for granted that students will just pick this up and know how to do it, but they really don't. I mean, if you look around in the classroom and the students that are successful, they have those skills. And oftentimes the kids that fall through the cracks are because they haven't really been taught how to be a good student. And so AVID ensures that all children will have those skills so they can all be successful.
Have you noticed some positive changes in the
Yes, I have. You know, Riverbend is a Title I school, which means about 40% of our student population is in free or reduced lunch. And you walk into classrooms, and it's amazing how kids, like today I worked in a second and third grade math classroom, and those kids, they all know where to find their binder. They were all getting their materials out. They could all just show their teacher attention with slant. You know, walking through the hallway, sometimes you hear the teachers going, show me slant. And the kids just, it's just kind of like this invisible, like everybody's just, not invisible, but it's like, it's you don't really hear it. You see it and feel it. Like all of a sudden the kids will just like show their good posture in their seat and they're leaning forward. And you can tell they're like really paying attention to the teacher. And it's just, and that's the culture. So, and then in fourth, fifth grade, the students are at the end of the day, they're opening up their binders, they're getting to their agenda, their planner, and they're writing down what they did that day, what they need to be doing for homework, and it's just a part of every single day. So that way when they go home, they know what they need to do. It wasn't like, oh, I forgot my paper, I don't remember what I'm supposed to do. It's all written down. And they also do something called DLIQ, where D stands for what did you do today? So it's like reflecting back on the day. The L stands, what did you learn? The I stands for what was interesting. And the Q stands for what questions do you still have? And so it just adds that piece where students are reflecting on their own learning.
So I just have a little bit of time left, but I'm curious, once they get into middle school and secondary school, is this all gone for them unless they're in the special AVID program?
Well, once you learn something, it's never gone.
Of course.
And so that's the goal, that they now they just will have these schools. And there's been we've been getting feedback from middle school teachers and same with the high school teachers getting their, the middle school teachers get feedback from the high school teachers, and that they are noticing that students come to school better prepared because they have these good skills.
I've been talking with Pam Garcia about the AVID program in the elementary level, and thanks so much for coming in and sharing with that with us.
You're welcome.
And that's it for today's Juno Afternoon. Thanks for joining me. Thanks to all the guests today and to Jeff Brown, our producer. To listen to any of today's interviews or any other Juno Afternoon programs, visit the KTOO.org website under Local Programs and Juno Afternoon. Please join us tomorrow at 3 p.m. for Juno Afternoon. Our host will be Ken Fix. We'll learn about this year's public market with guest Peter Metcalf. Christy Chambord will be here with an update on K2's holiday auction. Phoebe Rohrbacher will be here to highlight Sunday's World AIDS Day. And we'll talk with Abby Janes about the International Doula Network. That, Writer's Almanac, music, and more, Wednesday at 3 on KTOO-FM. And the weather for today is dense fog advisory until 9 p.m., this evening, rest of today, mostly cloudy, areas of dense fog with visibility 1/4 mile or less at times, chance of rain, highs around 39. Tonight, areas of dense fog with visibility 1/4 mile or less at times in the evening, rain likely. This is KTOO Juno. We rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We are also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
This will break the paradigm in which the belief has been that it's only the hardline, inflexible approach that is going to yield.